You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, promoting nuclear energy was a tremendous gamble by the United States. What have the consequences been of this promotion on the world? And first, the filibuster is threatening to block a great deal of the Democratic Party's legislative wish list. What is the history, the function, and the future of the filibuster? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The U.S. Senate is a unique legislative body in that it often requires a supermajority of 60 votes in favor of legislation for a bill to pass. This is due to a historic institution called the filibuster. But the filibuster, as we commonly know it from films like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, is not exactly like we think. Instead, it's evolved into a means to ensure the minority party can easily block legislation from passing with a majority. Today, we discuss the history of the filibuster, its purpose in democratic governance, and the future of the practice. Our guest is our old friend, Jeremy Suri, professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs and is the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, and Foreign Policy Breakthroughs, Cases in Successful Diplomacy. Jeremy, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Doug. Always happy to chat with you.
So when we teach the filibuster to high school students, we usually show them Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and this, you know, this scene of a senator holding the floor because of this extreme, you know, conviction. That isn't really what the filibuster is, though, is it? What is the filibuster?
So it has become a mechanism for the minority in the Senate to, on many issues, prevent any progress unless they get their way. They hold the majority hostage. And the way it works is that they can prevent anything from coming to the floor, even a discussion. So the Republicans never actually filibustered the idea of a legislation for a January 6th commission. They filibustered any discussion of the possibility of having a legislation. So it becomes a way of muzzling the Senate unless one side can get the consent of at least 10 members of the minority party. If you only have 50, if you are 52, then it's 8. You need 60 rather than 50, basically. But that's a modern phenomenon. Historically, the filibuster was rarely used in the 19th century. And then when used slightly more often in the 20th century until the 1970s, it was the Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where most famously Strom Thurmond stands and speaks for more than 24 hours to stop any progress on a civil rights bill in the 1950s. But we've moved to a world since the 1970s where the Senate has rules that allow senators to indicate that they're going to filibuster. If there aren't enough votes for cloture for 60, the Senate just moves on to another topic. It's called a two-track system. And it makes it pretty easy to filibuster. All the minority leader has to do is say, sorry, I have 41 people who don't like this legislation. Move on.
And historically, where did it come from? Because, I mean, it's kind of axiomatic. I think most people probably already know. It's not in the Constitution.
Not at all. And that's a really important point, Doug. I think everyone needs to recognize that the rules by which the Senate and the House operate are the rules they make. And they can be changed at any time by the Senate and the House by a majority vote, unless someone filibusters that majority vote. The filibuster actually comes from a pretty innocuous decision. It's a classic case, the sort of thing we love studying as historians, where a decision is made in a thoughtless way at one moment, and it has implications for the next 200 years. So Aaron Burr in 1798, when he is the vice president of the United States, he basically withdraws or gets rid of the rule that allows for a senator to call to previous question. This is basic Roberts rules of order. If we're in a committee meeting and you make a point and I think it's time for us to actually vote on the topic that you're talking about, I say call to previous question. And if a majority of the people in our committee meeting say, yes, let's call the previous question, then we actually vote on whatever the topic is. They eliminate that from the Senate rules, which means there's no way to stop a senator from speaking. If you take the floor as a senator, you can speak theoretically as long as you wish. And that means that one senator, in theory, can stop the entire Senate from moving on to anything else. The reason for this is because the Senate wants to be a place of free speech. It wants to be a place of open debate. And the mythology, and you'll hear people defending this today without any empirical basis, is that this is supposed to allow for more free speech. It never really does. What it actually does is it allows a small group to stop others from speaking on issues because they just hold the floor. Imagine if in your committee meeting you had a misbehaving faculty member, I know that's unthinkable, right? Who just kept going on and on and on and you couldn't stop them from speaking. That would not be encouraging free speech. That would be stopping any real discussion. And that's what it does. Through most of the 19th century, it's rarely invoked, very, very rarely invoked. It's used much more in the 20th century. It is worth saying, Doug, though, when it is used, in the 19th century, it's used really for one issue, to protect slavery, to protect any and prevent any discussion by Southern senators, preventing any discussion from other senators about any kind of modification to slavery, any kind of limitation on the power of slave owners and the fugitive slave law and other elements that allow Southerners to protect their slaves even when they go north.
So since it requires a supermajority, it seems to me that the filibuster is really a fundamentally conservative and kind of a broad understanding of conservative versus progressive type of institution, in that it tries to block the institution from taking steps without an overwhelming majority. Isn't there a value to that, though, that the narrative you always hear is Benjamin Franklin's famous line about how, you know, the Senate serves as the cooling saucer to try to cool the passions of the day?
I think that that's an argument in principle, but I don't think it really plays out that way historically. The purpose the filibuster serves in the early 19th century, soon after it's created in 1798, is for what is a very small, clubby group of men. It encourages them to come to consensus. And maybe it works in that small setting a little bit. And it's there's a kind of rule they follow that they don't use it very much. You're not supposed to, as a senator, put a filibuster on the table, start a filibuster just because you don't like a little piece of legislation. It's really to be used only in extreme circumstances. And it's part of the clubbiness. The Senate was a club. Even as late as the early 20th century, it was still a club of older white men from similar backgrounds. The problem is, though, as the country grows, as we get into the 1830s and 40s, as we become more diverse, it's no longer the same kind of club. It's not a small club. It's a much bigger, bigger group with different interests. And it makes it almost impossible to reconcile interests between different groups, because there's no incentive, if you are in the minority or you feel you'll fall into the minority, to give in. Why would you prefer to compromise rather than prevent the other side from getting anything that would be worse for you and keeping the status quo that's better than the change that might come for you? So that's why it becomes very conservative, but it's conservative not in a sense that encourages consensus. It's conservative in the sense of reactionary, classic reactionary politics, holding us back. It's what some scholars in your field would call, right, a veto point, right? A veto point in the political system. And that's why senators are rare to use it in the 19th century, because they see it is not a tool that is that useful in too many cases. And as I said, you can count the number of filibusters from the 19th century on your fingers. You can't count them on your fingers and toes, even for the last few months.
In the 19th century, when it was used, it was most commonly used to help preserve the institution of slavery. And then in the 20th century, prior to the most recent, say, you know, 10, 15 years, which we'll get into, it seems like it was most frequently used on issues of civil rights. Is that accurate? And then if so, I mean, obviously race is playing a pretty substantial role in here. Is the filibuster racist?
So largely, yes. There is a notable exception that's very important in the history of the filibuster. Through the 19th century, there's no cloture. There's no vote to stop the filibuster. So if you wanted to stop a filibuster in 1870, you just had to wait till the person collapsed. You had to wait them out. And if there were 10 people who were part of the filibuster, you had to wait them out. And that's why the Southern states before the Civil War, when they filibuster, they're able to get away with it, because no one really wants to wait that long for these guys to collapse when they're just speaking and speaking and speaking. The cloture rule is created in the wake of World War I, because there are a group of senators who try to use the filibuster to prevent the United States from funding and fighting World War I. So it is actually used by isolationists. And that's where the cloture rule is created. It's created because the vast majority of the senators did want to go to war, and there were enough to agree that they would create this rule. Originally, the cloture rule is 67 votes. It's then later moved to 60. So we've slowly chipped away at it. But with that exception, with the exception of the filibusters around World War I, it is predominantly then used in the 20th century, not to protect slavery, because there isn't slavery anymore, but to protect white supremacy, to prohibit anti-lynching legislation, to prohibit legislation that would eliminate public segregation, to eliminate legislation that would guarantee the right to vote and eliminate poll taxes. And Lyndon Johnson has to work, he would say, as hard as he ever worked, which is really hard, to get past those filibusters. That's really the impediment in 1957 that finally gets us a Civil Rights Act, and in 1964 and 65, Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts. And it honestly, it takes a war from Lyndon Johnson. He's got to buy off people. He's got to pressure them. It is the impediment then as it is now to civil rights.
So the filibuster, it appears, is being used a lot more frequently. Is it fair to say that this use of the filibuster as extensively as it is tied pretty closely to the current Senate Minority Leader, Mitch McConnell? Is the blame kind of laid at his feet?
Yes, in part. I think there's a rise in the use of the filibuster really as we get into the late 80s and early 1990s, and then it skyrockets from there. So maybe he takes a trend of increased use and then multiplies it many, many times over. I think the reason the filibuster gets used more is because in the 1980s and 90s, there's a movement in the U.S. Senate to undertake some major structural reforms to our democracy that are very threatening. And most of them do still circle around civil rights, D.C. statehood, for example. And so there's a desire by the Republican Party, for the most part, but not always the Republican Party, sometimes the Democratic Party, to use the filibuster to stop movement on those issues. I'm not sure partisanship is creating that. The filibuster might actually be contributing to the partisanship, because you have no incentive. This is why I think the filibuster is such a bad thing historically. It creates a disincentive for you to compromise. It creates more of an incentive for you to form your tribe. And if you can get enough people in your tribe, you don't have to have a majority. You can wield your power. You can hold things up. So it's a disincentive to compromise. Whereas if you have to get 50, then you need to compromise. You need to compromise on the legislation, not just say, I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to stop you from having any discussions.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the history and the feature of the filibuster with Jeremy Suri of the University of Texas, Austin. And one of the more interesting features of American governance is the ability to block the majority party from being able to pass legislation. I think of a number of European systems, certainly parliamentary systems, where when you win an election, you get to pass what you run on. And then if the voters don't like it, they vote you out next time. Whereas in the US, actually one of the more common complaints is that politicians make promises, but they don't keep the promises. But it seems like a lot of times that's because the minority party can actually block passing those promises. So is that unique, you know, to the US, that a majority is not really a majority?
It's a point I explored in The Impossible Presidency, and the new book I'm finishing also circles around this. Some elements of American society are more democratic than almost any other in the world. Our First Amendment rights. We have more First Amendment, more free speech rights than English citizens have, for example, right? But there are other parts of our system that are terribly undemocratic. And you've beautifully hit on one of them, Doug. Our system is set up to make it very, very hard for a majority to get things done. And this has three really nefarious historical outcomes. First, it allows a minority of white male slaveholders and then white supremacists in the South to wield inordinate influence in our system. And then that gets reinforced by gerrymandering. It gets reinforced by a Senate that represents territory, not people. So there's a piling on towards certain minority groups that goes back to the Constitution. This is a cancer in our system. Slavery is not the only element of this, right? It's the compromise to bring that part of the country in and that element of it, right? This is a bad thing about constitutions. On this case, the English have a point on us, right? Maybe if you don't have a written constitution, you can change these things more easily. Second nefarious effect or second element of this is that it actually then encourages the president to act more unilaterally. And there's this irony where members of Congress, you'll hear them complain about the president issuing so many executive orders. The truth is, if you study this as a historian, most presidents would prefer to get what they want done through legislation. They understand that works better. First of all, they want Congress to be responsible for it, not just them. And it has more longevity. It's harder to change. The Affordable Care Act has remained the law of the land because it's a piece of legislation, not an executive order. The Dreamers Act was an executive order, so it's easier to turn that around. But presidents turn, whether they're Democrat or Republican, they turn to executive orders, which aren't in the Constitution either, by the way, because the legislation is stymied. And that's a real problem. It encourages too much executive governance. And then there's the third element of it that I think is probably the most problematic of all of this, is that it discourages the solving of our problems through policy. We tend to try to solve them other ways. We look to market solutions. We look to all these other alternatives, which sometimes make sense. But we don't take the very serious, obvious policy avenues that we can take. And so our policy making is not as rich and dynamic as it could be. Taking the filibuster out of that would at least remove one of the anti-democratic obstacles to our system. And less people worry that if we got rid of the filibuster, all of a sudden 50% would be doing everything they want and the other 50% would not get what they want. There's so many other checks. I mean, imagine if the Senate could, if the Democrats in the Senate today could, with 50 plus the vice president, push through all the legislation they want to push through, whether you like it or not. Think of all the other impediments that still exist after that. So the fear of a tyranny of the majority is overstated by the minority to protect the minority interests.
What immediately came to mind is one way in which we replace this, the policymaking mechanism tends to be through the courts.
Yes, that's
then to use that as a transition. One area where the filibuster has been removed has been on judicial appointments, including the Supreme Court. And so is that coincidental? Is it ironic or whatever, that because of the filibuster, a lot more of these cases are being played out in the courts? And this is one area where the filibuster actually has been removed, is in judicial appointments.
Right. So this process begins when Republicans under Mitch McConnell's leadership, as the minority in the Senate in 2009, say that they're not going to confirm, they're going to filibuster many of Barack Obama, President Obama's nominees for different cabinet positions, which is almost unheard of. There had been a long tradition where the senator from a given state has the right to object to a potential judge appointment from their state, but not that you could object to the person the president wants as Secretary of the Treasury because you don't like their position on abortion or something like that. As a consequence, Harry Reid, who's the majority leader then, eliminates the filibuster for appointments below the level of Supreme Court justice. Mitch McConnell then uses that as an excuse when the Republicans have the majority under Trump to eliminate the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees. And it's really important. Right now, McConnell is defending the filibuster. If we kept the filibuster that he seems to love for Supreme Court appointments, we would have no Neil Gorsuch, no Brett Kavanaugh, and no Amy Coney Barrett. All three of them are approved with numbers far less than what you would need if they could be filibustered. It's in the low 50s for each of them. And so 51, I think, with Kavanaugh, in fact, right? So this is the filibuster has been chipped away in those areas. It wasn't a problem before, not because you had more moderates appointed to these positions. Antonin Scalia was appointed when there was still a filibuster. It was more because there was a tradition of showing deference to the president. And it's when that tradition is broken and the filibuster is used more that then you have to start peeling it away. And that's why today, so many of us who are historians say it's time to get rid of the filibuster. It's always been a problem. You won't find historians saying it ever works well, but it wasn't a problem that rose to this level because it was a bad weapon that was very infrequently used. Now it's a bad weapon that's being used more often. So we better disarm. We better take it out of the closet. And that's where I think we are today.
Now, each example you cited, particularly the last two, Harry Reid with lower court appointments and then Mitch McConnell with Supreme Court appointments, the filibuster was removed with 50% of the vote, with 50% of the Senate. So you can't filibuster getting rid of the filibuster. So the Democrats have 50 votes plus one. Why do we sell the filibuster?
That's a very good question. I think some of it has to do with the fact that one or two of those 50 plus one votes, particularly Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, it's not that they really like the filibuster. It's that he doesn't like some of the things that'll be done if the filibuster is eliminated. And he doesn't think his constituents like some of those things. So the filibuster is a useful excuse. And that's why I do think the voting rights debate is a really interesting one, because he is exposing himself. He can say all he wants that, well, it would be a bad idea to eliminate the filibuster even for voting. We did it in a small way. We could, as we've done for judges, we could just say you can't filibuster a voting rights piece of legislation. His Manchin's response would be, well, but then that'll give the Republicans reason and justification when they're in the majority to eliminate more of the filibuster. They're going to do that anyway. They've already done that to get three Supreme Court justices appointed, right? Why would they not do it for other issues? So it's not a compelling argument. I think what motivates Manchin and the few Democrats, it's only one or two or three maybe, who are holding up getting rid of the filibuster, at least around voting rights and DC statehood and other things, is they don't actually like the legislation that'll be passed afterwards. And they need to be held accountable for that. The Democratic Party is a much more diverse party. I don't just mean racially and ethnically. Of course, it is more racially and ethnically diverse. It represents a much wider, diverse constituency in the country. That's a strength and a weakness of the party. And here's where we're seeing some of that weakness. So Manchin almost doesn't want the party to be able to do what he's claiming he wants the party to do.
This last point gets me thinking, something I always wrestle with is how much, when we discuss issues, whether it's the filibuster or, you know, other principles, electoral college, et cetera, are we really talking about principles of governance? And the debate really rests with this principle of governance versus I have legislation I want to pass. And if the best way to pass that is through the states, I'll support the states. It's not really about federalism. If the best way to do this is to get rid of the filibuster, I'll get rid of the filibuster. Is it really about the principles of governance or is it really about the policy itself?
I mean, it's not a pure dichotomy, right? It's not one or the other, but I think it's mostly about power. And I think the historical record's pretty clear on that. Principles do matter. I think most politicians, not all today, but most politicians do have some core principles. They do have some red lines they won't cross. We saw this with many of the Republican senators who wanted nothing to do with questioning the electoral vote count, right? They didn't want to go down that road. They can say all kinds of horrible things about Joe Biden and even allow Trump to tell lies about the election, but they weren't going to vote to decertify and get into that mess. That for some of them, I think, was a principled line. They weren't going to go there. But with the exception of some principled lines, most actors on both sides of the aisle are pursuing what they think are the right things to do for power and for their constituents. And they use procedural arguments to enable themselves and disable their opponents. And the best example of this, by the way, is the 1876 election. I hate to take us back to history. I was just writing a chapter about this, actually. This is an election. We still don't know who won, Tilden or Hayes. And if you follow the arguments, and we have to have an electoral commission, and it really comes down to 2 days before inauguration until a deal is made to make Hayes president, you can see both parties making arguments on either side based on the state that they're in. So states where the Democrats think there are fraudulent votes by Republicans, they say we should be able to throw those votes out. But the states where the Republicans think they're fraudulent votes, then no, the Democrats don't want those thrown out in those areas. Hypocritical arguments are made both ways. We've seen that, right? McConnell defended the use of the getting rid of the filibuster so he could get a Supreme Court nominee. He even defended not taking on a president's nominee when it was Obama and then taking it on later and closer to the election when it was Trump, an impeached president. A president who we knew was in some ways violating the law already. It's not just McConnell. He's maybe the most explicit of this, but procedure is generally used by people, not 100%, 80 to 90% to get what they want.
A number of progressives have been critical that President Biden has not been more vocal about getting rid of the filibuster. He's complained about it. He's certainly thrown his support behind the some of the different, you know, voter rights legislation, the John Lewis Act and S1, the Senate 1 bill coming out. But he hasn't really committed his presidency to getting rid of the filibuster. So kind of a two-part question. Do you agree? And what does this mean for the future of the filibuster, at least in the next, you know, 2 years or so?
It's a great question. You know, I do think Joe Biden is a creature of the Senate that we've just described. And he remembers, and maybe he's misremembering, but he remembers a period of bipartisanship. He's friendly with some of the people on the other side. So he's attached to the filibuster in some ways that we are attached to the normal procedures we have in our places of work, right? Even if we don't like them, they're comfortable. They're comfortable old shoes. But I think there's something more to it than that. I think he's having conversations with his friends who are members of the Senate. That was not true for really the prior president, even the one before that. Obama was not very close to many people in Congress. Biden, these are his friends, especially some of the Republicans. And I think he knows that behind the scenes, he actually has a little more support from them. And he's trying to translate that. I think there are a number of Republicans who might not like everything in the Democratic legislation, but actually agree. Certainly believe that there's no evidence of fraud. They're afraid to say it in public. And he's trying to nudge them forward. I don't know if he'll succeed, but I think that's what he's trying to do. He will argue, maybe correctly, that assuming we have this bipartisan deal on infrastructure, that actually happened, that's what worked there. And it's a fine balance, Doug. You and I study this. There's no real formula for this, right? You have to bring the hammer sometimes. And sometimes, you know, you have to bring the carrots and the cake and whatever it is. And I think he's working through that. And we're lucky to have a president now who understands that. Whether he'll succeed, I don't know. I'm certain that he and everyone around him is absolutely committed to getting voting rights legislation through one way or another. They need that. They recognize that, but I don't think they have yet figured out how to do that. And that's going to be one of the dramas for the next 6 months, right? It's got to be done, really, not necessarily before the summer recess, but certainly by the end of the fall, they've got to have something in place.
And that is true. And I also appreciate your non-prediction, to say that it's not clear cut, but certainly this is a complicated issue, and it's going to be one that we're going to be watching very closely. We've been discussing the filibuster, the history of the filibuster, its purpose or lack thereof, and the potential for its removal in the future. Our guest has been Jerry Suri, professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He's the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership and Global Affairs and the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, and Foreign Policy Breakthroughs, Cases in Successful Diplomacy. Jerry, thank you very much.
I enjoyed it as always.
Thank you.
When we come back, what is the wretched atom? And what have been the consequences of the U.S. selling the idea of peaceful uses of nuclear energy? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The United States promoted the idea of nuclear energy as peaceful and plentiful. But what have the consequences been, really, of this promotion? Our next guest is the author of The Wretched Atom, and he explores this through formerly secret documents from the CIA and the State Department. Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Following the development of the atomic bomb and its use against Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the Second World War, the United States was confronted with the concerns about the development of nuclear weaponry. But the technology also presumably held peaceful uses. These ranged from the development of nuclear power for electricity, as well as broad issues for medical research and other commercial uses. So the U.S. seemingly had a dual interest in controlling which countries develop nuclear weapons, we call this nuclear nonproliferation, as well as harnessing the power of the atom for peaceful purposes. But it also fit a grand narrative and a geostrategy that the United States was implementing. In a new book, The Wretched Atom, historian Jacob Darwin Hamblin examines U.S. policy on nuclear weapons, on nuclear technology, in the years following the use of the bomb in the Second World War. We are discussing this research with the author today. Jacob Hamblin is professor of history and director of environmental arts and humanities at Oregon State University. Professor Hamblin, thank you very much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Absolutely. So in this new book, you're examining the way in which the United States framed peaceful uses of nuclear technologies against concerns, or presumably concerns, about proliferation of nuclear weapons. Can you briefly, you know, describe what exactly was the U.S. trying to accomplish with this policy?
Sure. This whole project started when I was doing archival research at the Food and Agriculture Organization, which is in Rome. So I was researching a previous book. My last book was called Arming Mother Nature, and I was looking for information about food security for that project. And I wasn't having the best of luck with, you know, finding great information at that moment. But I ran across these files by this botanist named Ronald Seelow. And they were just intriguing because they were really thick files that were clearly about some kind of a controversy that had been quashed by the Food and Agriculture Organization. In the 1960s, the International Atomic Energy Agency and the Food and Agriculture Organization together had this joint division where they were promoting atomic energy solutions in the developing world. And this particular botanist was kind of outraged by this, thought a lot of it was a scam, and accused a lot of his superiors of corruption and incompetence. And none of this ever got out, but here it all was in these files. And it's a kind of an interesting story, and I do talk about it in the book. And even if you don't come away from that story feeling like he was right or he was wrong, what was clear to me at the end of that was that there were a lot of people who wanted a success story in atomic energy, in peaceful atomic energy. People at the international level, people in the U.S. government, lots of other governments around the world really wanting these success stories. And so for me, I wanted to explore that story to try to see, okay, instead of thinking about the peaceful atom as this kind of idealistic, happy-go-lucky alternative to the warlike atom, which is what we typically see, I wanted to look at it as its own story, as its own story of geopolitics, its own story of manipulation, its own story of propaganda, and to really kind of focus on that. So, you know, looking at that time period right after World War II to really actually the whole second half of the 20th century, it was just a fascinating time for the United States, doing a lot of promising for these technologies, not always delivering on them, not even necessarily needing to deliver on them. But it just seemed like it was a ripe time. And this is the time of decolonization around the world, where a lot of countries were gaining their independence. It's for the first time in history, you see a massive shifting away from the US and Europe of a major natural energy resource, namely oil. So trying to figure out how the US kind of maneuvered in that kind of environment, I found it to be totally intriguing. And I felt like the atomic energy, peaceful atomic energy in particular, was an I don't want to say underappreciated, but definitely less understood element of that kind of maneuvering.
Yeah, peaceful energy uses, you know, building nuclear power plants certainly is a huge part of this. One of the things that I was really fascinated with your research were the different types of technologies, different types of promises on nuclear technology. It seems like it was more than just electricity generation that the United States, you know, was promising, was exploring. Could you talk about some of those?
Yeah, when these promises, as I'm describing them, really began to be made by the U.S. government as propaganda, I mean, today we think about nuclear power, electricity generation as being the main technology. But even then, in, let's say, 1953, when President Dwight Eisenhower made a very famous speech called that we now call the Atoms for Peace speech, you know, promising to share this technology with the world. Even then, nobody had built reactors for electricity generation, including the United States. Nobody had done it yet. So even then, it was kind of aspirational. But at that time, the kinds of technologies that the U.S. really had in mind to promote around the world was not electricity generation. It was, you know, things like things that most people haven't even heard of today, like mutation plant breeding or disinfestation of grain using radiation or sterilizing insects to control disease, you know, food preservation with irradiation, all kinds of potential things that you can promote. And in fact, one of the reasons why this was so helpful or useful for the U.S. to promote is because in the late 1940s, early 1950s in particular, the U.S. didn't have a lot of uranium. And so the U.S. government, as a matter of policy, did not promote atomic energy, peaceful atomic energy, if it had to do with nuclear reactors. Because they didn't want anybody to compete with the uranium for the weapons arsenal. So things that were kind of byproducts, essentially radioactive waste, like radioisotopes that, you know, are made through the fission process, those were something that the U.S. government promoted and said, hey, maybe you can use these. You can use these in a variety of different ways. And they were cheap. And they could be sent to European partners, certainly, but one of the big benefits was sending them to other countries around the world, including countries of what were known at that time, countries of the developing world. The other technology that I didn't even mention was, you know, pairing nuclear reactors later, pairing them with desalination plants, trying to desalt seawater to, you know, make deserts bloom. There are all kinds of things that could be done. At a certain point in time, detonating explosives, nuclear explosive, you know, essentially bombs, those could be used for, those were promoted by the U.S. as something that could be used for building harbors, you know, changing, making massive geophysical changes.
Yeah, one of the things, the themes, particularly in the early part of the book, was how fascinated the U.S. was and how they, you know, promoted this fascination with just this new technology. We had this image now that the U.S. had seen the destruction, the world had seen the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and were outraged by it. But that's not the theme that I'm getting, you know, from your writing, that it was much more that there was a kind of fascination that this really is the technology of the future.
Well, there certainly were some people who believed it was the technology of the future. And I do not mean to suggest that all this was fake, but from the US government's perspective, I can't emphasize enough, and I think I do emphasize it in the book, that none of it really had to be real. Because one of the reasons why the peaceful atom was such a formidable tool of state power in the 50s, 60s, 70s, was because it leveraged people's aspirations. It leveraged you know, developing countries' aspirations to modernize and to bring status of living, the, you know, quality of life to the point of Europeans and Americans. But what's key about that is that nuclear technologies have never had to come through on those promises. When you're promising something about the future, all you really have to do is to sell the promise. So yeah, there were certainly some who believed in that, but for the most part, this was conceived of as a kind of propaganda. I mean, this is not just true of Eisenhower's famous speech in late 1953, but it was true of his predecessor, Harry Truman. I mean, if you think about kind of just key moments in promises of the peaceful atom, you think of 1946, where you have there's this proposal that the Truman administration made about sharing atomic energy at the international level. Well, that was right at the time when the U.S. was starting to do post-war atmospheric tests of atomic bombs. And, you know, you need something to kind of counteract the ramping up of the weapons arsenal. It happened again when the United States decided to start the program to build the hydrogen bomb. It happened again, and you had a lot of propaganda about, you know, sharing with the world. And of course, in 1953, when President Eisenhower did it famously, This was very much a strategy to counteract what he knew was coming, which was a major series in 1954 of hydrogen bomb tests in the South Pacific. So, you know, they're conceived of as propaganda. And when you look at the archival documents, it's very clear that most of the government officials, and many of the scientists, I should say, as well, really had no idea what specific technologies they had in mind. It was a promise. And so there really was this battery of promises that were made, which is one of the reasons why by the time you get to the 1960s, you have so many people in the US government and also international agencies really just craving any kind of success story in all these domains. I mean, there's this sort of joke that these organizations were hammers in search of nails. You know, it didn't matter what your problem was, as long as the solution was a nuclear one. They could come up with some kind of a solution for you and claim it for the peaceful atom.
Another aspect of the book I found particularly fascinating was the way in which these newly independent countries, and the two that you specifically cite are Ghana and in India, as nations that saw nuclear technology as a pathway, not just independence, but to try to break some of the dependency that they had seen, what we today would probably call concerns about neocolonialism. Is it pretty consistent then, states seeing development of nuclear technology as a pathway to independence? And then the irony of that, because I know you talk quite a bit as well about the way in which that helps to build a dependency on countries like the United States for providing this technology.
Well, there's a lot there in that question. And there's each of those cases is going to be different, but you know, I do talk about Ghana. Ghana in the 1960s is a good example of what several countries went through, but this is a leading example of really embracing these promises. What we see, you know, from the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s and beyond is an embrace of all of the promises. And what Ghana tried to do is kind of an interesting story. So what Ghana and South Africa were doing in the 1960s were kind of competing for being the leading nuclear state in Africa. And South Africa had already won an early battle in that at the International Atomic Energy Agency. South Africa was really the representative of all Africa and Asia, despite being a white supremacist government. And so Ghana and Kwame Nkrumah, who's famous for a lot of reasons in the history of decolonization, in the nuclear realm, embraced the peaceful atom as well. And both these countries were sending people to these organizations, kind of both of them using the idea of the peaceful atom to kind of raise their profile in Africa. And it's a good example of, you know, it's not just about the United States manipulating people. It's also the idea of the peaceful atom is useful for lots of different states for lots of different reasons. So you have some really interesting racial politics happening in Africa in the 1960s and beyond. And Ghana was certainly a country that embraced the promises of the peaceful atom. The United States was not particularly helpful with Ghana. In fact, you could say the United States helped to crush those aspirations by helping to overthrow Nkrumah. India is a I would say a totally different situation. All the racial politics are definitely there as well. You know, in the book, there are a lot of interesting tension points where you have the United States government trying to frame issues as East and West, and the United States is trying to help people modernize, whereas India, which at the time in the 1950s was trying to be a kind of a leader of the neutralist movement, is trying to embrace the language of colonialism and racism and trying to call out countries like South Africa and the United States for racist politics at home and doing all kinds of things the United States really didn't want them to be doing. India is a fascinating case, and I can't do justice to it here in the nuclear world, because India also embraced the peaceful atom and embraced a lot of these promises that the Americans were making. They also tried to hold on to some of their mineral wealth. There's a mineral that a lot of people haven't heard of called monazite, which early on in nuclear history, people thought, well, maybe monazite's going to be very important because it's needed. Monazite sand is important for thorium. And there was a time in which people thought people were going to be making thorium reactors. And the Americans were very irritated with India for holding on to, not exporting their monazite. India also very clearly did not want to join what became the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. You know, saw it as being something that favored the global north, favored industrialized countries, saw it as, you know, even a kind of neo-colonial organization. So, you know, there's a lot in each individual country that we could talk about. But what's important, I guess, in all of that is, you know, for the for people who might be interested in this book, the individual stories are truly fascinating in the ways that they try to engage with different countries try to engage with these issues. But you know, a lot of the disputes about atomic energy we imagine to be between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And that's definitely true. There was Cold War. There's a lot of arms race issues in this period. But most of the bitter disputes that occurred at the international level, certainly within the International Atomic Energy Agency, were not east-west. They were north-south. And they were certainly by the 1980s, the factions that kind of aligned in the IAEA were, you know, former colonial powers, the Europeans, in other words, and the United States, and sometimes the Soviet Union, aligning themselves against the what were known as the LDCs, the less developed countries. So what I would like to do with the book is to draw people's attention to that and to look at the peaceful atom as being very much wrapped into the story of post-war decolonization politics. A lot of racial stuff, you know, in racism stuff in this book as well.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the campaign to promote peaceful uses of nuclear technologies, of nuclear power, and a new book entitled The Wretched Atom with its author, Jacob Hamblin. So, with respect to the IAEA, that was something as an international relations scholar I found particularly fascinating, because we usually present the IAEA, this is an international agency that the U.S. helped to create ostensibly, so it's not the U.S. necessarily directing policies on nuclear power, nuclear proliferation, but it has a certain international legitimacy. But the narrative you tell about the U.S. and the U.S.'s allies and its control of the IAEA kind of really pokes some holes in the notion of this independent agency. Could you talk a bit about, you know, the role the IAEA has played?
Sure. Yeah. Most of what we understand about that agency's origins is complete baloney. It's just not the case. And, you know, this was an organization that today, if you read the news, that they're often called the, you know, the UN's nuclear watchdog. And we have this conception that they were created specifically to police and to make sure that that people weren't developing nuclear weapons. That is not the case at all. That is not why it was created. Over the years, you know, part of the story of the book is to show that the kind of evolution of a lot of these organizations, and, you know, certainly the IAEA is one, into this kind of global surveillance policing organization. Remember that when this organization was created, IAEA, in 1957, really as, you know, very much a direct consequence of that Atoms for Peace speech, there was no such thing as a nuclear proliferation treaty. This is something that happened more than a decade afterwards. So there's a long period of time where the people who were in the IAEA, they were promoting atomic energy. They were looking for nuclear, you know, success stories, but they also didn't have much of a mandate beyond that. And the idea of using the IAEA as a way of kind of policing a non-proliferation treaty didn't sit well with everybody. I mean, it's the NPT, which exists today, it's got, I don't know, either around 200 countries that are members of it or less, maybe more or less. I haven't looked at the latest numbers. I mean, there are a lot of people who are part of this organization, the NPT I'm talking about, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But, you know, some of the people who always said, no, we're not going to join this NPT, like India, said, why would we join this? This is something that is trying to keep these technologies out of the hands of other states and keep them in the hands of those who already have them. And oh, by the way, you know, India and others, it's not all people in India who are making this claim, but oh, by the way, the only reason that this non-proliferation treaty was ever negotiated was after the so-called colored bombs started appearing. right? China detonated a nuclear bomb in 1964. And that is what really got the ball rolling on the United States and the Soviet Union and Europeans saying, we need to make sure nobody else gets this bomb. It wasn't after France got it. It wasn't there. Those are also part of the racial dimensions of the global non-proliferation regime. And after India detonated theirs in 1974, their what they called a peaceful nuclear explosion, a lot of people said that this was a great betrayal of the idea of the peaceful atom, even though, you know, the United States had been promoting detonations for a long time. And in any event, it's an interesting moment in 1974 when India did that, that really got really strengthened the resolve of Westerners, the Northerners, like the United States and Europeans, to really clamp down on the nuclear trade in ways that they certainly never had in the past. And it has ramifications for other countries too. I mean, a lot of the promises that were made to places like Iran, for example, things got a lot harder after India detonated their so-called peaceful nuclear explosion.
Another one of the themes about this development of nuclear technology and nuclear power that you'll cite is the way in which issues about development of these resources reframe the question of why we develop new technologies to focus on sort of human need or economic need as opposed to issues of environmental degradation. Peaceful use, as we tend to think the greatest concern is development of weaponry, but any of us who've studied environmental issues know issues, for instance, like waste developed from nuclear power plants is easily as much of an environmental threat. So how much is this really about shifting norms to say, we'll deal with the environment later, if at all?
There's a little bit of a schizophrenia about environmental issues among in the atomic industry. And again, there are a lot of people who are interested in atomic energy, nuclear energy today, that are sincere in their concerns about the world. So I'm not trying to paint with a hugely broad brush. This book isn't so much about industry as it is about governments. And so what's kind of interesting when you think about what atomic energy is in the hands of a government, certainly the United States government over many years, this is a bipartisan thing. So it's, Democrat, Republican, they all did it. But it's also in other countries. In the hands of governments, atomic energy typically has thrived in a cornucopian narrative. This is something that is not my invention. I talk about this idea of cornucopian a lot in the book, but it's something that has been used over the years. It just refers to the fabled horn of plenty from ancient Greek mythology, right? Where it's a promise of peace and plenty. So you need to make sure that atomic energy promises something, promises development, promises economic advancement, promises modernization, promises food. It can be really basic, promises access to water, more foods, more variety of foods, something that is going to be positive. Or curing cancer, medicine, climate change. We're gonna solve climate change. All these kinds of arguments are very standard fare for atomic energy and have been for over seven decades, right? So that's a cornucopian message. But it also involves environmental things, right? I mean, I just mentioned climate change. So you would think that would make it very pro-environment. You can say, hey, you can. Instead of spraying pesticides, Rachel Carson in the early 1960s warned us not to indiscriminately spray pesticides. Instead, we can irradiate insects and cure diseases that way. We won't need it. It's a biological control. Those kinds of arguments have been made a lot with atomic energy. So in one respect, they're very much alive to the arguments of, environmental things. On the other hand, you also have a little bit of tone deafness if there are toward other kinds of concerns. If there are concerns that are critical of nuclear power, concerns about radioactive waste, concerns about nuclear accidents, concerns about long-term health effects to exposure to radiation, whether it's occupational exposure or living near a nuclear power plant, those kinds of things tended to get way played down, not just by the people in the industry, but also by governments. And so you have these two narratives, these are two very much in contradiction narratives in play. And you know, one of the things that I do talk about in this book is that cornucopian message and how important it is, not just for environmental issues, which are very important, obviously, but how much that cornucopian message is baked into international affairs right now because of the need for different governments, including the United States, to try to control the nuclear trade, whether it's for weapons or whatever. You have got to make sure, if you were the United States, you've got to make sure that the IAEA seems like a legitimate organization. Otherwise, the entire nuclear nonproliferation regime falls apart. So of course you're going to say, yes, we're going to cure cancer. Yes, we're going to solve all your environmental problems. Yes, nuclear power is the way, it's the future. It's the way, the truth and the light, so to speak. You have to have this promise of the future for any of the other stuff to be legitimate at all, which makes that promise kind of problematic, right? You know, some people are going to look at this book and say, oh, he's an anti-nuclear guy. And it's not really meant to be an anti-nuclear screed. It's, you know, you open the newspaper in any given week, right? And there'll be something about, well, maybe nuclear power is the solution to climate change. Well, that argument comes from somewhere. And there will definitely be certainly industry boosters who will say that. And many are doing it because they really believe it. Again, I'm not trying to say that these people are dishonest. But when that is the position of governments, you have got to recognize that there are reasons governments must take this position. And historically have done so, as I said, for decades. It's not a new argument at all, and it certainly is not specific to climate change.
That's a wonderful point to, you know, to stop the conversation and encourage everyone listening to pick up this book. This is a wonderful historical narrative placing a number of these questions into its historical context. I think of that last point about the way in which a number of advocates for nuclear power are saying, nuclear power doesn't release carbon dioxide. So therefore, our concerns for climate change, we need to include nuclear power to try to replace some of our current energy infrastructure. And also, I think the context of wonderful chapter at the end, where you talk about the way in which advocates wrestled with Chernobyl. And I was thinking with that, that the same thing happening with Fukushima, and to try to recover nuclear power and nuclear technology and say it's really not that dangerous. The title of the book is The Wretched Atom. The author is Jacob Darwin Hamblin. He has been our guest. He's professor of history and director of environmental arts and humanities at Oregon State University. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you to our guest and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker, host, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.